Governor Stassen, I would like to take you back 38 years to what must have been an almost electric moment at the San Francisco conference when you were involved in drawing up the Charter of the United Nations. And if I may, I will quote some of your own words as you enthusiastically recounted this happening in a speech some 9 days later.
And 38 years ago. You're already reaching back there.
Yes. And this is what you said at the beginning of this speech, and I think it's rather nice. It was a thrilling moment on the afternoon of June 23rd, 1945, when the question was put to the steering committee of the conference as to the approval of the charter as it then lay before them. The result of hours and days and weeks of discussion and dissension, of conference and of compromise, of translation and revision. It was late in the afternoon in room 223 of the Veterans Building, where so many earnest discussions had taken place. The arguments over clauses had been carried right up to the hour immediately preceding this vote. Chairman Stettinius asked if there was any further discussion. There was no response. Then he said, "Those who approve of the charter will raise their hands." The interpreter immediately restated the question in French, and down the long tables the hands of the chairman of delegations began to rise. The secretaries quickly counted, turned to the chairman and said, "With your vote, sir, it's 50 votes or unanimous." Do you recall how you continued? What you said was very moving. Somehow, in the atmosphere of that room, as you looked from face to face, as you thought of the 1.5 billion of the world's peoples that were represented, of all colors and of many races, tongues, and creeds, as you realized that most of them had stood together through extremely difficult years of bitter fighting and suffering in the war, there was a definite inner feeling that the conference had been a real success, that this United Nations Charter might well become one of the truly great documents of all time. You were obviously elated. You went on to deliver quite a long speech, which I think would have broken your campaign rule of never speaking for more than 20 minutes, in which you explained.
Was that the one in Washington, D.C. after?
That's right, the one that was.
That was a report in Washington.
Yes, and it was broadcast, yes. I think, nationwide.
Yes.
You called it a truly human document, and you explained its weaknesses, its strengths, and set out broad policies for the future.
I think I said we had obtained a beachhead.
You did,
in that
yes.
one, in mankind's
yes,
long struggle for peace.
Yes.
That it did not guarantee peace, but it was a beachhead that then would be there for the future. Eh?
Well, what we would like to do today is to try to capture the long days of consultations and meetings, the high points and the low points and the atmosphere, something of the behind-the-scenes negotiations, and of the conference through your mind and senses as you participated in it and as you contributed to it. Now, before we launch into recollections of the conference, I wonder if you could cast your mind back yet another few weeks, just before you went off for briefings in Washington. Was your appointment to the delegation a surprise to you?
Yes, in one respect, in that I was out in the war. I was out on Admiral Halsey's staff. The background was that, see, I had advocated publicly, oh, I think as far back as January 8th in 1943, that there should be a United Nations organized to follow through after the war. And I'd spoken quite extensively about that before I'd gone on active duty in the Navy. And also, of course, had spoken in some of the dinners in Washington where President Roosevelt had been present. And I was also chairman of the National Governors, and in that context had some conferences with President Roosevelt on lend-lease and so forth. Then I'd gone off into active duty in the war, and actually the background, the moment of surprise really was when Admiral Halsey called me into the his cabin one day and put a dispatch across the table to me. It was a dispatch from President Roosevelt coming back from Yalta, asking him whether he would send Commander Stassen back to the United States for the United Nations Conference. And that was my notice. I had had really no up-to-date information. We were very actively in the war. And then Admiral Halsey said, Harold, do you want to do this? Of course, the dispatch itself, as I say, was a surprise. And in my own mind, I had, of course, been working and advocating steps toward world peace for a number of years. And I'd felt really that as a young Naval Reserve officer, even though I was also a governor, that when Pearl Harbor had happened, that my right thing to do was what I did do, and that was resign as governor and went on active duty in the war. And in a way, I thought that I was leaving behind my real life goal of working toward world peace. Then, of course, that message from President Roosevelt showed that he had remembered my advocacy, and he named me as the third of our party, Republican Party. See, Senator Arthur Vandenberg was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the leading Republican in the United States Senate, and Congressman Eaton was the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs, the leading Republican in the House. So I was then the third Republican that he appointed. And I think it's quite clear that if I hadn't been out in the war, he could not very well have reached over everyone else in the Republican Party and recognized the fact that I had been advocating that there ought to be a United Nations. Perhaps, as far as I know, I was the first one in active public life in the United States to advocate that there should be a United Nations. I think that was said back there years ago, and I don't remember of anybody claiming they advocated it earlier than I did. And those speeches, of course, are on record. So then when that dispatch came, I said to Admiral Halsey, of course, I'd very much like to do it. And he said, what about your section of the staff? I was then Assistant Chief of Staff for Administration. I said, well, Admiral, you've always told us we have to have two officers ready to take over if anything happens in battle, and I have two such officers, and I'd recommend that one of them, Lieutenant Commander Herbert Carroll, should take my place. And he said, well, when that's over back there, would you like to come back? And I said, yes, very much. So the orders were drawn that I was to leave Admiral Halsey and go and report to President Roosevelt for the purposes of the drawing up of the United Nations Charter, and when that was completed, I should rejoin the staff, which is what I did.
It must have
That's why it was as a kind of an unusual circumstance in that I was there for the signing, for the drafting through those weeks. And I was also present then for the surrender in Tokyo Bay at the end of the war. You realize, of course, too, that when we convened, the war was still going on, mm-hmm. both in Europe and in Japan, and as in the Pacific Ocean. And the while we were there, the VE Day came. It was in May, I believe, May 6th or 8th or something yes. like that. So we were in session in San Francisco when VE Day came, and we had completed the charter, and I went back out into the Pacific before VJ Day, before the ending of the war in the Pacific. So that was that background. So then I flew back with those orders and reported to President Roosevelt in the White House, and we had a discussion of the objectives of the United Nations, and then I went back out to the fleet for a brief time to get the organization set up, then came back to join the delegation in the preparatory work of the United States delegation for the beginning of the conference.
Yes.
And then in the midst of that, President Roosevelt died. So the time I had flown back and saw him in his White House office, in the Oval Office, was the last time I saw him alive. Because then I was in San Francisco when the flash came that President Roosevelt died. And then very shortly, President Truman reappointed the same delegation. So that was why it's sometimes said that the delegation was appointed by both President Roosevelt and President Truman, because he did reappoint, and he was necessary for him to, and he did the same delegation to take part. And that delegation then met and prepared for the San Francisco conference.
When you say you met President Roosevelt, do you mean you met him privately before you met him with the delegation? I think the delegation went on the first day that they met together officially in Washington.
I met him privately when I flew back. You see, his dispatch to Admiral Halsey, and my orders were to return the United States from the Pacific Fleet and report to the President. So I first reported with him, and then we later, the whole delegation then also saw him. But that was a personal conference when I first reported back.
Could you relate something of your discussions? Do you recall?
The fact that, for one thing, of course, it was very evident to me, and I had worked with him before I went out on active duty as chairman of the governors, that my first impression was that he had failed considerably, that he did not look well, but that he still had that vigor of action as far as his emphasis in his speech of the necessity of getting a charter drafted, and that it would not be easy. And he spoke a bit of his conferences at Yalta. And I noticed he poured himself a glass of water on his desk, and his hand was very shaky. So he was not really very well, but he was very determined about the necessity for a United Nations, and that he was confident we would do everything we could to get a successful charter.
If we could talk about perhaps one or two of the delegation meetings. When you first met all together, I think all the delegates were present at the first meeting. Had you met many of them before? Did you know them personally? Or Secretary Stettinius, for instance, did you know him?
I knew them all, yes. Mm-hmm. You see, I had been very active in public matters before the war. So I knew everyone in different degrees. And I had met Virginia Gildersleeve in some of the New York, I think at the New York Herald Tribune Forum was held in those years. And Virginia Gildersleeve, the one woman on our delegation, was the Dean of Barnard College, which was at Columbia.
And she was also very in the Navy, I think.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you. She was also in the Navy, I think, too, wasn't she?
Not that I recall, but it could have been. She could have been a consultant or something. But she was very active in education, a leading educator, and a very strong member. And, of course, those who were in public life, I already mentioned Senator Vandenberg and Congressman Eaton of our Republican Party, and then of the President Roosevelt's party, there was Senator Tom Connally, who was the Democrat from Texas, and Congressman Saul Bloom, who was the senior Democrat in the House of Foreign Affairs, and then, of course, Secretary of State Stettinius, and Dean Gildersleeve and myself, we made up the seven. Cordell Hull was also named, but he was not able to actually participate. He was the former Secretary of State. So the seven of us then, I think every one of the seven knew every other one of the seven and had our own varied backgrounds.
It was really quite a clever selection of a delegation with the
both President parties. Roosevelt, and you think of it, reaching to both parties and both houses of the Senate and the House. He, of course, had very much in mind the great problems in the United States structure after World War I, the League of Nations, and all of that, and the problems with the Senate. So that I think he very wisely reached out to the two ranking people in foreign matters in both parties, in both houses of Congress, and then simply with the Secretary of State And he, in fact, he told me when I reported back to him that he, of course, remembered very clearly various speeches I had made and statements I had made from the preceding years. See, I had been very active in public matters, and I'd been, governor for, it was in the third term that I resigned and went on active duty in the Navy, my third term, and I had also been serving for 2 years as chairman of the National Governors, so we had a lot of contact. And so he knew my views, and he knew that whole situation. It was a very interesting group of men and women. Then we developed quite a group of advisors and staff. As I say, to begin with, the war was going on. So in flying back from the Navy, of course, leaving my own Navy staff out there to carry on in the with Admiral Halsey, and then not having turned over the governorship to my lieutenant governor, Edward Thigh, who later became a United States Senator, too. But see, when I resigned as governor, he became governor. So that whole staff was there. So literally, I was flying back from the Pacific with no staff at all. And as I thought of that, I sent a telegram to some of the presidents of universities that I knew, President Conant of Harvard and Dodds of Princeton, and asked whether they could check whether they had some exceptionally brilliant students in international matters who'd been out in the war and been wounded and got back. And they cabled me various recommendations, and that's really the way I filled my staff, and I had a remarkable staff out there, men like John Thompson and Cordmeyer, men who had been brilliant in international studies and been out in the war and wounded and back home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way they were made available.
Personal aides.
They became more than aide, actually staff, my staff.
I see.
And then from the Foreign Service, another interesting thing happened was that shortly after I arrived back, the State Department, in developing their personnel for the conference, asked if I would mind taking on my staff for those aspects of the trusteeship that would deal with Africa, a young Foreign Service officer by the name of Ralph Bunch. And I listened and I said, not for African affairs, I'll take him for a comprehensive staff position like anyone else. And of course they were rather taken back, but they then did assign Ralph Bunch to me, and we developed a tremendous relationship at that time that then carried on through, because he was a very superior individual, as the UN records themselves will show. Mm-hmm. And he worked with me all through the conference, along with Ben Gehrig, who was another Foreign Service officer. They were the two Foreign Service people, and then the young veterans that I spoke of made
what
up my personal staff.
What about Leo Pasvalsky? Because I think he was involved
well,
with independent
Well, he, of course,
areas.
Came in from the delegation as a whole. He was appointed as a coordinator, and he did not have any relationship to me personally, only through the delegation. There was a considerable delegation staff and so forth. That was another matter.
I think after the first session of the delegation preparation meetings in Washington, you were not there through the rest of the meetings when they reviewed the Dumbarton Oates proposals, were you?
No, I'd gotten all the documents. But see, then I had to go out. I flew back out to the Navy in order to make certain of the transition because, as I said, I was assistant chief of staff for administration in what was then the greatest fleet that had ever been at sea. And I, of course, wanted to see that Admiral Halsey's responsibilities there and my responsibilities to him were carried out right. And so we worked out the transition and Lieutenant Commander Carroll taking charge and all the various things. And then I came back and rejoined the delegation. But I took the Dumbarton Oaks papers and all the other memoranda with me and went flying over the Pacific reading all those papers.
You weren't present, I think, at the second meeting of the delegation with President Roosevelt when he briefed the delegation on the three votes question reached at Yalta. and the later meeting when the delegation's recommendation to the president about United States requesting only one vote. Did you get briefed on this by anybody afterwards, or did you just...
Yes, well, I, of course, followed all the minutes of meetings and things of that kind, and knew that, in effect, compromise, where the Soviet Union would then have the extra votes under the circumstance where they had been saying that the United States had so many associates, had so many votes that way, and they looked at it. And this compromise had really been reached between President Roosevelt, as I understood it, and Marshal Stalin and Mr. Churchill. See, there were, that's probably a good place to reach out broader. When we got into the very difficult and long negotiations on every part of the charter at San Francisco, we analyzed what, in effect, was the parameter within which we were meeting. In other words, we were a delegation representing governments. There had been these sessions of President Roosevelt and Marshal Stalin and Winston Churchill. And, of course, there was the whole matter of the war still going on to begin with, and what agreements had been made, where there might be flexibility. And we very early, particularly Senator Arthur Vandenberg and I, realized that we had to think through at what point, if we were not able to get the right, what we would consider the best charter, would it be better to fail to have a charter? In other words, you had to think of the ultimate situation. What was essential to make it a desirable beginning, as contrasted to saying, well, we can't get a charter for a world organization now, and we better just go home and then after the war is over try to do it again, which we knew was a very grave thing. But that is the background for one of the most significant areas. This question of the veto and the interpretation of the veto in the Security Council took a lot of consideration, and you undoubtedly know that there were these various phases. That is, we had the U.S. delegation meetings, then we had the meetings with the so-called five-power meetings, and we had various bilateral meetings going on. Then, of course, there were meetings in the formal commissions and committees and plenaries, and a lot of negotiating. But one of the crucial questions on the veto power was whether the veto could stop even a discussion, and whether the veto could prevent any kind of action in the assembly. And there was a lot of earnest examination of just how that should work out. And really, Senator Vandenberg and I, and I think the U.S. delegation, after a lot of discussion, concluded that if the veto could completely stop any kind of an expression in the United Nations, and any kind of inquiry, any kind of assembly action, it would be better not to make a start under those circumstances. And that's led to then President Truman sending Harry Hopkins over to see Marshal Stalin. And the background of President Truman's decision to send him and his going was that the at least surface directions at that point we felt would have made it impossible for the organization to be effective. So there had to be some yielding on that point of the veto. And then out of those further negotiations and the further conference of Hopkins with Marshal Stalin came the revisions down to the point of where the actual practice has followed since that time.
How did you become so involved in trusteeship?
Well, first of all, by being assigned to do it. We divided up. Each member of the delegation had certain things they took on especially. And it happened that there had not been any advance agreement on trusteeship. See, the issues were so intense between the colony position and the mandate position and all of that, that it had not been possible for them to get any kind of an advance agreement. So that they early felt that unless this could be worked out, there probably couldn't be a charter. That is, that if it wasn't clear what was going to happen and how the procedures would be handled over the mandates that had come out of World War I and the many colonies that were then around the world, that you couldn't really get started in a United Nations organization with its objectives. So that fairly early in the assignments, I was assigned to the trusteeship phase, and that's how I got into that. I was also assigned fairly early to be the one that would go out and brief the media, because in the early stages there were a lot of misunderstanding of the media, what was happening, and a lot of sort of dire predictions of impossibility of agreement and things of that kind. The usual, one of the problems in the early stages would be that a perfectly natural thing with so many different viewpoints and different countries represented, that if some individual country delegate felt aggrieved or frustrated, he'd search out the press and give a very gloomy or rather distorted view, and that would become the world headlines. So very early our delegation decided that the media had to be briefed as to really in perspective what was happening, and then they asked me to take that on. So that was one of my other responsibilities, and that was the way we divided different assignments.
You also had the responsibility for Security Council, I think, didn't you, with Senator
With Senator Connolly. Tom Connolly. Mm-hmm. Senator Tom Connolly really was in...
Yes.
We usually had two members of the delegation on each aspect, with one of them, in effect, being the prime and the other one the deputy. We were already seven equal people, but in the way in which we'd organized to get things done. And on Security Council, Senator Tom Connolly was number one, and I was his second, so to speak. Mm-hmm. On trusteeship, I was number one, and Congressman Bloom was my second. And that's the way we kind of divided up organization-wise to follow these things up.
It's very funny, because in the official records and all the notes at the time, you were not assigned to trusteeship in the official records.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it's very strange. You were assigned to judicial. Did you ever have anything to do with...
Yes, I did some work on judicial.
You did some work with that. Mm.
Yes.
I'd like to go back...
I think that quite often is... I don't recall all the background, but I think that a lot of those advance papers were more or less what the staff thought should be, and then the delegation would actually make the decisions when things come together.
Were the decisions made in Washington or in San Francisco?
No, the decisions made right in San Francisco the delegation on things like that. Of course, Secretary of State Satinius was always there, so there was always that consultation and his communication and with President Truman. But as far as the, working methods, the delegation very much was a group that moved with the authority of a delegation. But as I said a little earlier, we tried to be perceptive as to the framework in which we were working. That is, this wasn't anything that was unrealistic, because there were governments involved, there was a war still going on, and there were presidents and heads of state that had made commitments, and so we had to think, how do we shape a charter under those circumstances?
I'd like to take you back to Washington, the briefings, just for a moment, if I may. How did you get your briefings on trusteeship? Did you have any ideas of your own? Or was it completely new?
No, of course, I'd been, you might say, aware of the world. I knew what was going on in the world and had been a very active student from early years, but there were briefing papers. But you see, really, when the work began on trusteeship, there were divided opinions of just how to do it in almost every government, as well as between governments. There were very strongly held views between different parts, even of a foreign ministry or a State Department minister, just what to do. And consequently, it had been impossible to get any kind of advance document before the session convened. And then in our early meetings, we couldn't get any document. That many kind of proposals had been put forward. And that was where we finally decided, really, between Ralph Bunch and Ben Gehrig and Cord Meyer and John Thompson and I, and talking it through, that we came upon this sort of technique, which they all said there was no diplomatic precedent for it, but we had to break through in some way. So we laid down one day what we called the working paper, as a position of no government, but as a document that we could start to work from. And we spent a few days then talking about what was the status of the working paper and what did it really mean and so forth. And then finally they turned to beginning to look at the paragraphs of it and start to amend. So then the trusteeship part grew out of that working paper over a long period of time. And
yes, that was sort of jumping ahead a little bit for me, because I'm still very interested, if you don't mind, by the last three meetings of the delegation in Washington, where I think you had a galaxy of admirals and secretaries of state all putting their various views. And I wonder if you could recall for us those meetings at which I believe you were present.
Well, there were, I might say, the natural apprehension that there is in every government of whether or not some kind of agreements would be made that would be a handicap to the security of the country, or would be an obligation.